Welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP content, and specifically we're going to be looking at the software development security. Now, security has obviously been a theme throughout all of these episodes, and we've talked a little bit about software security. But in this one, we're going to focus on the development lifecycle, right? It's very important that security is thought of not at the end, not as an afterthought, but throughout the entire software development lifecycle. And there's several models that are in use when people are developing software to make sure that it's secure. And here to help us work our way through all of that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
Good, good. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Hope everybody had a happy and healthy one. And to kick the year off, we're going to talk about some really cool and exciting stuff. We're going to talk about how we understand and really apply security within the SDLC, within the development lifecycle. You know, we often have talked about and we continue to think about as security professionals the need to be able to focus on security at multiple stages, right, within the development lifecycle, within the lifecycle of a system, whatever you may think of that as. And we will often talk about the fact we need to secure early and secure often. This is really how we as security professionals need to be thinking about security, need to be considering it, need to be focusing on it. From a perspective of where we kick in security, how it comes into the system, how we see it emerging in the lifecycle, how we track it, where we see it interjected, if you will, and then managed, the CISSP needs to be thinking about this at all levels of an organizational thought process, all levels of a system thought process. It's our job as a CISSP to ensure that security is not only thought about whenever and wherever possible, but it's always present. It's always there. It's always something that we are either bringing to the forefront. Let me try that again. The forefront, either through our actions, our words, our deeds, and or strategically as we look to manage through the organization with policy, with procedure, with operational thought processes, and we look to our teams to help guide and implement the strategies that the business needs, we really have to be thinking about the impact of security and thinking about how we manage security down through the organization as a CISSP. So the thought process around development lifecycle management, the thought process around security within the SDLC, whether it's a system or software development lifecycle, SDLC can refer to different lifecycles as an acronym generically. Regardless of what it is, as early as possible in the life cycle, as often as possible throughout the life cycle, is where we want to see the focus on security emerging and the focus on security continuing to be as prevalent as possible with our discussion. So beginning from that perspective is where we really want to start our conversations this morning as we really think about getting started with you, as we look at how we're going to integrate the thought process around development life cycles within the security framework. It's all about the CISSP's understanding of how to create a secure environment and how to push that secure environment forward at every possible opportunity. You know, we define the phases of development by using an SDLC, a development life cycle. We have to select the model that's most appropriate. And you heard Mike mention in the intro that there may be several different SDLC models. There could be the waterfall. There could be the spiral model. There may be iterative models that we look at. Just-in-time development, rapid application development. There's all these different models that exist out there. And we'll highlight some of them. We'll talk about what some of them are. Some of the more popular ones, obviously, are important to at least have passing knowledge of. But whether you focus on this as a primary area within your organizational expertise, in other words, what you may do already as a CISSP candidate, what you may do already as a security practitioner, or this is new to you, and this is something that you don't do very often. You know, most security professionals that either I know as peers or colleagues, or that I come across just in my daily activities, talking to customers, interacting with students and professionals. Reality is a lot of them have passing knowledge of the topical discussions we're going to have, but really aren't experts in this area. They just don't spend a lot of time focusing their efforts and their thought process on how to secure the development of a system or a software product from the ground up. They take it and run with it once it's been created in effect at the output, the back end of that product, and they manage it. And that's where most of us probably, reality would, you know, normally show us that most of us probably operate at that particular area of the life cycle, the very end of it, the output, in other words. But it's important for us to know that at every step along the way as we begin that journey, there's opportunities for us to interject or in some way insert our not only our thought process, but also our knowledge and our ability to understand how to manage and therefore focus on security. And it's important for us to be thinking about how we do those things and what those things may look like. The generic phases, the generic thought process around an SDLC can be carved up and explained or discussed more or less along the lines of what I'm going to mention to you now. There's some disagreement in terms of what the overall thought processes around an SDLC may look like. In other words, there are standard models you can look at, but there's not a hard, fast rule that says every SDLC is going to look this way no matter what. Every SDLC is made up of these five or six or seven phases, no matter what. But generically, you will find that these phases, or at least allusions to them, are going to be referenced in pretty much every SDLC that you will see out there. So at a high level, project initiation and planning, very important to think about that. Where do we start from? In other words, how do we start our journey? How do we lay out, do business requirements analysis, and lay out overall the needs of the project? What are we going to address, and kind of what is going to be the measure of success ultimately by understanding what our functional requirements will be and how we gather them from our stakeholders? Functional requirements definition goes into project initiation and planning, part of that. System design specifications, how are we going to design? What does the system have to do? You know, these are all things that we think about as we do requirements analysis, requirements gathering, and we start to begin to have the dialogue or dialogues with stakeholders about what their needs are and how we're going to design a system that will help us to meet them in some meaningful way. Development and implementation. How do we take all that information we've gathered across project initiation and planning, functional requirements definition, systems design specification? How do we get all that together, and how do we use that to actually now start to build something and ultimately move towards implementation where we're going to be able to not only have a POC, a proof of concept, and maybe some sort of a generic system that we can use and test and tweak, but ultimately produce something that will be a finalized product. Document that. Documentation is going to be very important along the way. We're going to test that. We have to make sure that what we deliver ultimately not only stands up to all the expectations of the customer, but meets or exceeds all the functional requirements and specifications that the customer, the stakeholders, have given us and said, this is what you need to do. And so we're going to do all of that through development and implementation, and then ultimately take that finished product once we've documented it, once we've standardized it, tested it, make sure that it works the right way. We've certified and accredited it, and we'll talk about what those terms are as we go through this, and then ultimately transition to production. How do we ultimately put that out there, give that effectively to the organization, back to the stakeholders that have asked for it, have paid for it, ultimately have waited patiently for it, and how do we then, hopefully patiently, right, and then how do we operate that system or that software, whatever it may be, over the life cycle, whatever the life cycle has actually been specified that it will be. So we really start with project initiation and planning. We move through function requirement definitions. We move through system design specifications. We do development and implementation. Documentation and testing are done along the way, and ultimately transition to production, meaning the shift from, hey, we're testing, we're building, we're figuring it out, to, hey, we got it right. We've drawn a line in the sand. Stakeholders have signed off. They've accepted responsibility for running the system as delivered, certification and accreditation, in other words. And now we're transitioning to production, and we're going to now hand that over to the stakeholders, to the business, and effectively allow them to then take ownership and start to operate and over that life cycle, maintain that system. That can be a life cycle that stretches days, weeks, months, years. In many cases, it will most likely be years. We don't make significant investments in product development and the life cycle to secure those products unless we're willing to operate them for a significant period of time. But every project has to have a life cycle associated with it, meaning every product ultimately that we deliver has to have some sort of endpoint and vision for it. So we know 3 years, 5 years down the road, whatever that is, that we're either going to be updating that system, changing its overall look, feel, and function to make it more relevant to the organization, extending its functionality, in other words, extending its life cycle, and or we're going to end that life cycle at a period of time, again, whenever that may be down the road, in order to effectively bring that particular system to a close, logically, functionally, with the appropriate security controls and decommissioning controls in place to do so, and then perhaps bring something on behind the scenes that will either take on that function in a new and innovative way. We could look at, for instance, the transition from non-cloud to cloud-related services, and how to move a system into the cloud may involve actually decommissioning elements of it that were old and really not made for the cloud in any meaningful way, and reproducing that system with new functionality, but allowing it to be linked to the cloud. And this is something we're seeing time and time again with the move to cloud-centric system and service delivery today. So that's one example of where decommissioning may imply new services, new systems being brought online. with a reintroduction of that servicer system, but with an updated look and feel and an updated security posture and functionality. Or we may simply decommission that system or service and no longer need it because we're no longer offering that. We may look at something like an older mainframe system that did production management or perhaps did data management for us on a platform that's going out of service, and we no longer need to offer that service in the organization. We're going to decommission totally the data and the systems associated with it, and we're simply going to end of life them. And the EOL marker, the end of life marker, is the endpoint for that service functionality or that system functionality. And we then, once we decommission properly, walk away from that, strip down the systems, get rid of the data, safely discard it, whatever we may need to do. But once that decommissioning has happened, the SDLC for that particular product or service has been completed. The end marker for end of life has been reached, and we no longer need to worry about what that may look like. So we want to be thinking about these phases, want to be thinking about how they're going to operate. The trick to doing this from a security practitioner, security manager perspective for you as CISSP candidates, the trick to doing this and doing it well is to understand the expectations that you have to meet at every level, at every phase of the SDLC, have them well documented, make sure you have a roadmap, in other words, right, that explains where you are, where you are coming from, and where you need to go in order to be able to move from one phase to the next. The trick, in other words, is clear and accurate documentation and clear and accurate planning to move through cycles as opposed to a lack of understanding, a lack of clarity that can lead to confusion, but also potentially lead to a compromise. You may inadvertently, without realizing it, or thinking you're doing something else, move through a phase, and because you haven't clearly documented what the phase transition point, the success metric or metrics will be to move out of that phase, and we don't clearly understand them, you may move through that phase without hitting all the key markers you need to hit to ensure success. And in doing so, you may actually build in an insecure system or insecure solution into that system in such a way that it affects the overall outcome, number one. But number two, may impact confidentiality, integrity, and/or availability, right? The three key information security management pillars that we build all of our discussions around and have talked about throughout all of our time together across the width, breadth, and depth of the CISSP knowledge we've been helping you to better understand, right? Every one of the domains, every one of the eight areas of knowledge you have to master as a CISSP to be successful is built around understanding of confidentiality, integrity, and/or availability in some form, mixing and matching along the way, to understand how these three things play into and are impacted by our discussions, right? We have to keep them in mind, in other words, in everything we do. And if we're not focusing on them as part of the SDLC conversation, we're not doing our job effectively as a CISSP. So ensuring clear, accurate documentation, clear, accurate understanding of what it is we're trying to accomplish is going to be central, is going to be critical to our ability to create that success path. In project management, we talk about critical path management, what's called CPM. Those of you that have an understanding of project management hopefully have heard of this and understand what it is and use it on a regular basis when you create a project timeline, you create your statements of work, you create your work breakdown schedule, all of that stuff, right? So when we talk about CPM and critical path management, it's the idea of understanding how to get from where you start to where you finish with the least amount of resistance along the way, but maximizing success. I'm making it overly simplistic when I explain it. There's more to it than that. Join us for a discussion on PMP in another episode sometime later. But the reality is, right, when you think about CPM, critical path management, you think about how it applies as a generic concept to what we're talking about within security and secure development life cycles, it's actually a very appropriate way to think about how to do this end-to-end because it's about defining clearly what those markers are that can create either success or failure at every phase and understanding that we've passed through them and we've documented that we've done so authoritatively in order to move forward, or we are struggling to get through one or more of them and we have to stop and figure out what the problem is. And we may have to engage in either some sort of trade-off conversation or negotiation with stakeholders in order to figure out how to retrench, redocument in effect what our new, quote unquote, solutions are going to be because maybe we're not going to be able to hit the mark that we have set for ourselves because there's a problem. You know, for instance, we may run into a resource issue, may run into a time issue, a money issue, a person issue, or a requirements issue. The requirements may no longer be aligned with what the customer or stakeholder wanted because they've changed their mind. And any one or all of these things can happen along the way. And so we have to understand that there may be points in the SDLC where it may be appropriate, and indeed it may be necessary, for us to stop and to have a conversation with a stakeholder or with a group of stakeholders, validating where we are by reporting out on our progress, but also validating that the customer is still engaged, that the stakeholders are still where we need them to be, and that our agreement in the beginning of this process still holds true. And it's very important to do this, right? This is that, hey, what do you want to do tonight conversation that you may have with a significant other, spouse, or somebody in your life, in the real world outside of security, that you engage in, right? When you say to somebody, hey, what are you looking to do tonight? Do you want to go out and see a movie? You want to go have dinner? You want to have drinks? What are you in the mood for, in other words, right? You're validating with them at a generic level what it is they're interested in accomplishing. If you have a generic conversation with somebody, you get generic answers. If you say to them specifically, hey, I was thinking I want to go out and do dinner and a movie tonight. Is that going to work for you? You're asking them to be very specific and focused on a solution, right? And when we do requirements gathering, we're asking the stakeholder, the customer, to be focused on a solution. We're asking them to partner with us and to be focused on what it is they want to accomplish. We've talked about the fact we have to align this with business requirements. And the stakeholder represents the business, the customer represents the business, the organization. And we have to align with their thought processes in order to create something of value for the organization. It's up to the CISSP to validate that alignment and to ensure that the project manager, that the business analyst, the people that may do the requirements gathering, as we've discussed, that they understand that they have captured those requirements and have aligned them properly. There's nothing worse than starting a project, going down the road of starting to develop something securely, to find out halfway, quarter way, eighth of the way, three quarters of the way through that what you're doing is not what the customer has asked you to do, wants you to do, or is expecting you to do. And we've all had those epiphany moments, right? Where we've been told at some point, hey, why are we doing X when we should be over here doing X plus or Y plus or whatever, but not X, right? And that's a critical concern, because that can lead to not only wasted time and effort, resources misallocated, misrepresented, misused, but it can lead to an insecure solution, or the state of something could be left in an insecure way because we have partially done something, but we have not finished it. And now we've been told, by the way, what you've done is no good. Not only do you have to unwind that, but you have to go back and do something different. And that can lead to all sorts of complications. So we want to be very clear, very focused, very aware of the need to be not only aligned here, but to have clear understanding, documentation, and checking for relevancy of that documentation at every phase is going to be a crucial step in the success metric or success cycle that the CISSP needs to engage in with SDLCs. So project initiation and planning, we've talked about that, right? Aligning project objectives, as we talked about, scoping strategies, other factors are all discussed here. Function requirements and definition, comprehensive analysis, making sure systems will meet end user needs is what we're doing here. We've talked a lot about these things in other discussions. We've talked about them from various perspectives in the system and talked about the importance of not only requirements gathering, but function requirements definition and getting those right. System design specifications, designing system and software, establishing the data input flow and output requirements, designing security features in to the system. These are all things that will happen in these particular areas. Development and implementation, all about generation of source code or building of a prototype, if we're talking about a system as opposed to software. We're focusing the SDLC conversation on software development in this particular conversation. So the S is for software, but I just keep reminding you, because I want you to know that the S could equally and easily be for system development lifecycle. SDLC is generic in that respect, and it can equally be applied to either one, but we are focusing on software in this discussion, so I just want to keep you aware of that. Developing testing scenarios and test cases, conducting unit and integration testing, documenting for maintenance purposes, all these things will happen in development and implementation with regards to the software project we're involved in. When we think about doing all this, we have to think about acceptance and what the acceptance requirement is going to be for the stakeholder, for the customer. In effect, how are we going to hand that project or that output to somebody and say, hey, this is what you asked for. Here's effectively what we have for you. And please take a look at it. Please come back and tell us whether that meets your expectations. And if so, we need to agree, both of us, you as stakeholder and or customer, me as the provider of the solution, we need to agree that we've both accomplished our tasks, and we have to then decide what we're going to do going forward, meaning put this product into ultimately, you know, operational capabilities have to be turned on. We have to operate and maintain this system. And then over time, we have to decommission it. So we have to move through the remaining areas of that life cycle, but we have to agree that we have effectively hit the mark in order to do that. And so acceptance becomes very important. Independent group testing is usually done to ensure acceptance, meaning we bring in somebody or some function that will allow the system to be tested Testing is a critical step on the path towards being able to release a system, ensuring that all the pieces, as well as the implementation of all those pieces together, is going to actually meet the expectations of the client or of the customer. So we want to be thinking about that. Testing and evaluation controls have to be implemented as part of acceptance, as we talked about. We should be testing with known data, known good data in the system to ensure that we understand what the system will do, how it will behave, what the functionality of the system will be. We should never use live production data for testing. We need to make a copy of that data, move it into a testing environment, and then test it under controlled circumstances. If we test live in production and something goes wrong, we may actually negatively impact not only stability of production systems, but we may actually inadvertently compromise confidentiality and/or integrity of those systems, and that can lead to catastrophic failure. So we always want to test in an isolated environment. We may use, and indeed should use, production data, but we should copy that data into an isolated, secure, non-production environment. And then as a result of that, don't you like when somebody just randomly reaches off to the side and goes, hello, right? Just right out to the side of the screen.
Yes.
I wasn't planning on going that far out when I reached, but it was just one of those things. So we should always make sure that we use that. We call that sanitized data, right? The idea of taking data that's coming out of the live production environment, cleaning it up to ensure there's no information that could be compromised. We've talked a lot about the importance of data loss prevention, of DLP technologies, of IRM, information rights management, of privacy overall, of privacy protection, things like tokenization, obfuscation are terms that would come to mind here, want to think about. So we would take that data, we would secure it, we would make sure that the data being used in the non-production secure testing environment is protected. But it has to have the integrity and the availability requirements of the live data associated with it, and it has to look and feel like live data. So we just want to make sure we're sanitizing it and securing it, but we also want to make sure it's functional and will give us accurate representation of what the data implies, and therefore the system functionality will effectively represent itself the way it would in live environments. So we want to be thinking about that. We've talked about certification and accreditation. I mentioned those terms. Want to make sure we understand the process, and I believe we've discussed this in one of our prior episodes. Want to go over it again. Certification is the idea of taking a system and ensuring that that system effectively has been delivered to spec. In other words, you know, the customer said, I want X, Y, and Z, and we effectively have delivered X, Y, and Z in that system. So we are certifying that the system effectively has delivered the functionality that the customer or the stakeholder has asked for. That's what certification is all about. So we can present that certification document along with the system, the software, whatever it is that we're certifying, to the customer, to the stakeholder, and effectively say, hey, by the way, here's your solution. Here's documentation that validates that we are effectively on target. We are certifying we've done the things you've asked for. All your requirements, functional requirements, have been met, and this is the documentation to that end. Certification is all about validating for the stakeholder that the system has met the design requirements and is being delivered according to those requirements. Accreditation is all about the stakeholder accepting the risk, the liability of taking that system as delivered, as certified, and then managing it effectively and putting it into production. So if it's a software solution, it's about the customer taking that software, turning it on and operating it. If it's a piece of hardware, it's about the customer taking that hardware, putting it into production, operating it, maintaining it over its life cycle. So accreditation is all about the process of being able to, as the owner of the system, accept responsibility for the system and ensuring that the system will be operated, all bumps and warts aside, everything associated with it is going to be acceptable, and the risks, hopefully all of them are documented, or at least all of them that we understand and know are documented, because we do know there is such a thing as residual risk and there is such a thing as unknown risk in a system, and you want to make sure you're aware of those terms and what they mean. But all the risks that we can identify, that we are aware of, are documented, and the owner of that system, the stakeholder that represents the organization, has agreed to sign off and accept that system as delivered. This is what accreditation is all about. Certification accreditation is really a government, military kind of thought process. We don't tend to see this very much in the private sector. It does occur. There are organizations and businesses where this general thought process is followed. But this is not something that in the majority of the private sector you would come across. So you may or may not have ever seen or been involved with this process, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Never been involved with certification or accreditation, no big deal. If you've heard about it but never seen it, it's not that big of a deal at all. But it is important to understand generically what the concept represents, just so if you're asked about it, In other words, if you ever hear a question being asked about it, somebody wants to know about it, you can knowledgeably and intelligently explain it to them, interact with them, help them to walk through the process. And as a CISSP, remember, one of our primary focuses in the business is to provide guidance and to provide that voice of experience and that knowledgeable viewpoint or vantage point that the business can rely on. And so we may be asked to provide guidance in this area. Somebody may say to us, hey, we're partnering with an organization that has this new requirement that we haven't really dealt with before. They're asking us to certify and accredit our solution. Do you understand what that is? And Mike, as the CISSP, may say yes or no, right? Or I, as the CISSP, may say yes or no. We have to remember, give guidance where we can. But most importantly, we have to give guidance where we can add value and we can be knowledgeable and we're not just effectively faking it to make it, as somebody told me during the break. I love that thought process. Had a long conversation with somebody about the idea of faking it until you make it. And this idea, and actually it was based on a TED Talk that we actually took a look at, which is really interesting, about this idea of how you can effectively become good at something by doing it repetitively to really understand it and effectively get better at it every time through iteration. That's important, and that's a thought process you want to think about, and as you become a professional in this area, practice over time. But what you don't want to do is give somebody guidance or offer them the benefit of your experience where there is nothing to back that up. And my point is, you don't want to fake it till you make it with regards to something like this, because if you say to an organization, a stakeholder that's looking for your opinion as a professional, as somebody who should understand this, oh yeah, I know what that is. Let me just tell you, it's this, this, and this. Do it this way. You're fine. You don't really understand it. And let me be clear, understanding it is not the definition that you read the Wikipedia entry and therefore you think you now are an expert at that. You see those commercials, right? You stay smart. I forget what hotel chain does that.
Yeah,
but you stayed smart last night.
Yeah,
whatever it is. Yeah, I stayed at such and such last night. I can do this, right? I've never done brain surgery before, but I stayed smart, so I can do this. That's not how CISSPs operate, right? Just to be clear. We don't want you to give guidance to somebody, an entity, an organization, if you are not comfortable doing so. Remember the ideas of due care and due diligence. Also remember the code of ethics that we've talked about several times. It's your responsibility, and you sign off and agree to uphold the code of ethics before you will become certified as a CISSP formally. It's part of the application process where you effectively specify, yes, I've met the requirements, experiential, exam-based, I've passed the exam, I've done the experience thing, I have 5 years of experience cumulatively in two or more of the domains required, I've sent my application in, I have my application fee, I've done all that stuff, I have my recommendations or the people that are willing to vouch for me, all that's done, but you also have to sign off on upholding the code of ethics. And it very clearly says you will provide guidance to and uphold the requirements of not only your organization, but the industry and the community that we all service as part of being CISSPs in good standing at large. And you will do so with honor, with integrity, and with good intention. And the idea is that you should not knowingly ever provide false guidance or in any way provide misdirection. I'm not suggesting you would, but what I'm implying is that if you speak to something authoritatively in the eyes of your customers, your stakeholders, and you're not actually knowledgeable and authoritative as a result, you may not mean to. You may have the best of intentions at heart, but ultimately, by doing that, because they think of you as the voice of experience, they look to you as being the expert, if you give them incorrect information, even if you did it by accident, and I'm sure it wouldn't be on purpose, I'm sure it would be by accident without meaning to, but if you do that, you still effectively have gotten to the same place, right? You've given them incorrect guidance. You've given them, unfortunately, information that may or may not be accurate, and you have not done the things you've been asked to do and indeed said you would do by upholding the code of ethics. So acting honorably, acting justly, those are important things to consider. Due care and due diligence are important bylaws and watchwords for us as CISSPs. You have to remember that and be aware of that. So this idea of being able to understand certification and accreditation is also going to be very important for you. Again, just as a thought process, just as a general overview, so you can help somebody work through that if necessary. When we think about transitioning to production, we often call that implementation, by the way, in case you're referred to that way. We're thinking about getting accreditation and certification out of the way. We're training new users, very important to think about. Training and awareness, and part of that, how do we train users? How do they use the system? How do we document what we've done? How do we make sure we communicate that effectively? This is all part of the transition to production or implementation cycle. Want to make sure we're thinking about that, along with implementing the system, obviously. Revisions and system replacement may happen, as I indicated, over time. And if we are updating a current system, that revision process is going to kick off a new SDLC, or at least it should if you do this the right way. And a new SDLC should be implemented every time we make a change, because even though it may be a minor change, you may literally just be implementing a quick fix, some sort of an update, security patch, new functionality, whatever it is, you are effectively modifying the system. And we'll talk about and have talked about change management and configuration management and the importance of those to the overall security process. And we'll remind you of those again as we continue our conversations in this knowledge area and in some upcoming episodes. But it's really important for you to understand that anytime you make a change, you have to effectively go back through that SDLC process, kick it off, walk through all the phases again. Some of them may be a lot shorter and may be much more constrained because you may not have to do very wide and very broad functional requirements gathering and business analysis to understand the requirements. You may have one simple requirement: implement this particular change. But you still have to document, you still have to test, you still have to implement, you still have to operate, you still have to manage and ultimately decommission over that life cycle that change. You have to integrate it into the existing system. So revision and system replacement needs to kick off its own SDLC, and you want to make sure you're aware of that and thinking about that to understand how that ultimately comes to fruition. As we wrap up our conversation in this area, at least initially to get started, we also just want to point out to you and think about the fact, as I mentioned, there are several different ways, approaches we can jump into to carry out the SDLC. There are what are known as capability maturity models for software development. We generally call them CMMs, capability maturity models. There is a software capability maturity model. There are different maturity models that exist out there. The generic idea of a capability maturity model is the idea of going through a phased or stepped and very well documented set of phases to move from a less well understood, less mature, less documented state in the organization or the system, or in this case, in software, through very distinctly defined phases towards a more documented, more understood, better, more mature phase towards the end of that life cycle. We move up, in other words, typically, in maturity. And so we go from a very immature or very well, a lack of maturity, a very misunderstood or very lack of understanding, very lack of understanding, that's a technical term, not a lot of understanding in the system. In other words, not well documented, not well understood, not very mature, to a, you know, more graded thought process up over time towards a higher level of maturity, ultimately higher level of understanding, better management, process is implemented, procedures are implemented, things are audited, they are validated, they are checked, they are well documented. This is the progression we make as we move through a capability maturity model. We just want to be thinking about that. There's also ISO standards that may be valuable here. We've mentioned several ISO standards along the way. ISO 90,000 and 90003, 2014 is appropriate to most software development and software quality management. We talk about TQM, total quality management, with regards to the ISO standard. So ISO 90003, 2014 is the current update on that. So that's going to be a TQM solution that helps us focus on total quality management and allows us to understand how to do so from a standardized, internationally approved, or at least internationally accepted way of doing things across borders and across organizations. We thought about operation and maintenance as a cycle area as well. We've talked about that. Turning on the system, getting it out there, monitoring for performance, ensuring continuity of operations, detection and defects of weaknesses, and then documenting those so we can go back and fix them over time. This is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, where we actually turn the system on and operate and manage it accordingly.
Very good. All right, Adam, a lot of great information on software development security, and I know we got a lot more to go. So a good look at some of those models, though. I love that phrase, you know, security early and often. I think it's really what we want to keep in mind. So remember, if you guys want to attend one of Adam's classes live, shoot us an email here at cadam@itpro.tv. Signing off for this episode, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm Adam Gordon.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care, everybody.